Hello for next English talk. This talk is about privacy, and so we have a lot of things going around about violence of privacy outside in the world, and it's very important to get some ideas how to get some good privacy claims. And Simon and Alex will present you something here, very strong privacy claims, how to get them, and they are both PhD students in the field of privacy, more or less, so enjoy their talk.
Well, hello. So today Alex and me will give you a short introduction to differential privacy, what it is, what it can do for you, and also which limitations it has and where you have to be careful. Now it works. Okay, so short intro, who are we? I'm Simon and this is Alex. And we both are PhD students at the KIT, at the Chair of Practical IT Security. And I myself work on building anonymizations and then testing them, seeing how they work. And outside of work, I'm a beekeeper and a bee enthusiast. And Alex works with formal methods. So instead of doing practical experiments to see if an anonymization works, he uses math and to prove that certain privacy levels are reached. And he's a DAC enthusiast. So here we go. What to expect from this talk? We're going to give you a short introduction to differential privacy. We're going to keep the math part low, but we try to give you a good intuition of what differential privacy is, how it works, and where the limits are. And then in the middle, we're going to do some hands-on experience with you, because differential privacy can be used to do surveys, and we're going to do a short survey with you. And in the end, there's a short part about how differential privacy techniques in general can be misused, and how we can spot that. Now, before we start, first a few definitions a few basic things about privacy. So one of the first notions of privacy is the right to be let alone by Warren and Brandeis. And they came up with this notion because photography was invented and newspapers went into, for example, weddings to take pictures of people and then publish them in their newspaper. And they called for the right to be let alone and therefore also the right on your own picture. So the photo policy of the GPN comes from a long tradition of privacy notions. Then we have the information self-determination, which also actually comes here from Karlsruhe, from our constitutional court, because they found in the 80s, after a census, that each person has the right to decide which information they share about themselves and with whom. And then a more modern notion is contextual integrity, which means that there are certain privacy expectations in given context. For example, if you go to a doctor and share your medical information with him, then you expect this to be private. If you do this in a crowded marketplace, then there's less expectancy that this remains a private information. Now, what can we do to protect our privacy? I myself work on anonymizations. So an anonymization is a technique that tries to remove all identifiable information of you from data, from biometric data, from databases, and to unlink you from the data. And a basic example is here, for example, just blacking out the face. You maybe know that from various newspapers that you said, or a bit better, blurring the entire face. But even with these anonymizations in place, some information is left. For example, here you can still spot the skin color and the hair color. So while we remove a lot of information, not all of them are removed. And if you think about something like a database, then the information you would remove are, for example, names, email addresses and so on, which are direct identifiers. But you would also look for tuples of attributes, for example, sex, age, and your origin and where you live already are a good tuple to identify you. So there's also these quasi-identifiers. And anonymization seeks always to remove these information from the data. Now we have an anonymization, and now we want to learn how good does it work. And as I do empirical research, I build an experiment and a test. So for this face example, we would use a face recognition system, ideally the best we can find, and run both images through it and see how good can we still identify that person. And then we can say, okay, our anonymization removes a lot of the identifiable information and we get less accuracy. Now we have some idea how good the privacy of the anonymization is, but we also need to look at another part of it, because the best anonymization is actually super easy. We can just make this black bar super big and just remove all the information, so delete the data. However, we also want to do something with the data. And this doing something we call utility. Means we have some application for which we want to use the data. Let's say you take a picture with friends and then there's people in the back. You might want to remove their faces only, and then you can still post it to social media without compromising other people's privacy. So there's a bit of a trade-off between having utility so that the data is usable and having a privacy protection. And yeah, usually these two goals conflict a little bit with each other, and we have to find a nice trade-off for that. Now, this problem with my method of measuring anonymization or privacy is that it could always happen that tomorrow someone comes and has a much better face recognition system. I can't plan for that, so I can only take the best we have today and see if that works. And with my method, I essentially get a lower bound how much privacy loss you have from something. So I can measure the best we have today, but the actual privacy loss we have is probably a bit higher. Now, what we want to talk about today is a theoretical approach where we use math to prove kind of the worst case that can happen. So what is the most privacy you can lose? And for this, we use differential privacy. And now I hand it over to Alex, who will talk about that more.
Yeah. So thank you. So suppose that there's a duck pond, and there's a data analyst that wants to know something about the population of the ducks in the pond. In this case, he's interested to know if there's a disease outbreak in this pond. And to do so, luckily, the duck, there's already a database that exists that's mostly nearby that, I think, is it me?
You have to put the microphone away from the screen.
Yeah, now? Okay. So luckily, there's a hospital that has data from the individuals, and this can give an answer to the data analyst. So ideally, the data analyst would like to ask the hospital for their database to obtain his answer. The thing is that this database, or hospital database and medical databases, are extremely privacy, are extremely sensitive and contain a lot of confidential information. So the hospital would like to protect this data, wouldn't want that the analyst knows exactly who has which disease. And therefore this process, if I put it this way, hello? Okay. How? Okay, now?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, sorry people. Oh God, I cannot. Okay, thank you. In this case, the hospital would like to protect their information, and therefore would send this information through a protection mechanism. And the goal of this is that the individual information or the confidential information about the users is not present in the output, but the global statistics, the information that would actually allow the data analyst to know his answer, are still present. And a way we can do this is through differential privacy. So differential privacy is basically a property of the protection mechanism. And the idea of differential privacy is that if we have two databases that are equal, but one contains Alice and one does not contain Alice, the idea is that the outputs are going to be very, very similar. That's the whole goal. And the idea is that they need to be so similar that an attacker, when they see an output, cannot distinguish whether this output came from this database or this database here. The thing is that it's very clear that the output that came from the database that did not contain Alice does not contain any information about Alice, and therefore an attacker won't be able to learn anything about Alice if they see that output. But since these two outputs are very similar, the attacker can also not learn a lot of information about Alice from this database here. And the idea of differential privacy is that it can assume a very strong attacker. So the attacker can know everything about the database and still is not able to infer whether Alice participated in the database or not. Here, this difference between the outputs is what we measure with the epsilon of differential privacy. And basically, what we impose is that the probabilities between these two neighboring databases are bounded by this epsilon, or the relation between these two. And the idea is that we are not only protecting Alice, but we are protecting any difference. So we are protecting Alice, but also Bob in the second record and whoever in the third record. So we are protecting every individual in the database. And therefore, we impose that a mechanism is differentially private if for all possible outputs and all possible neighboring databases, that mean databases differing in Alice, in Bob, in whoever, this value is bounded. So the question now is exactly how to select this epsilon, or what this epsilon actually gives us. And what we know is that smaller epsilons correlate to higher indistinguishability, so a larger sense of privacy. But how much epsilon do we actually need? The answer to this question is that it's slightly unclear. We need to test which values of epsilon we need. But what we know is that the epsilon limits the amount on which the attacker success can increase after seeing the output. That means that if the attacker had a 50-50 chance of correctly identifying which database corresponded to the output he sees, after seeing the output, it can increase, in this case, to us around 73%. So if the epsilon is 1, the attacker can increase his success rate to around 73%. If we select an epsilon that's much higher, like, for example, 7, we see that the attacker success can increase, in the worst case, to basically 100% success, which is a very bad privacy guarantee. In this case, that's the reason why we usually impose very low values of epsilon. So we are saying epsilon lower than 2, lower than 1. But the literature does use a lot of epsilons that are larger. Like Google, for example, uses sometimes epsilon equal 100, which provides very weak privacy in this set. To see an example of differential privacy, we introduce, let's see randomized response, which is a very old method that predates differential privacy by almost 40 years. So this is from the 60s. And the randomized response is basically a surveillance method where respondents are asked a confidential yes or no answer, but the individuals can actually answer confidentially. And the process is very simple. So you're given a yes or no answer where you answer correctly. Then you randomly draw a number between 1 and 4 in secret without letting anyone see this number and invert your answer if it's a 4. If it's a 1 or 2 or 3, you don't do anything. And at the end of the day, you report the value that you have. In this case, there's individual privacy because an attacker won't be able to know if you draw a 1, 2, or 3 and therefore are telling the truth, or you draw a 4 and therefore are lying. It's impossible for the person to know if they do not see your random number, which is secret. And this process actually satisfies differential privacy, or a local variant of differential privacy, with an epsilon similar to 1. And since this process is so simple, we thought it would be nice to actually test it with all of you. So we are going to do a very short quiz on randomized response. Here is a QR that generates a random number. We politely ask you to join us with this test. and remember the process. So in the next slide, you'll see some embarrassing, is very mild, but slightly embarrassing answer, I question, and you answer yes or no without revealing it. Then you use the random generator to generate a number between 1 and 4. If it's a 4, you invert the answer, and otherwise you don't do anything, you answer truthfully. And then we are going to count how many of you say yes, and then how many of you say no. To, we also have the total of people that are participating today. So our first question is, do you use Windows as your main operating system? I'll give you a second so you can generate your number. I suppose that's enough. So how many of you answer yes? Remembering that if you had a 4, you need to change your answer. So how many of you answer yes? Could you raise your hand, please? So we have... Okay. Yeah. And how many of you answer no? On 20. 40? 20. OK, we have more questions for you. So at the end of the day, we do not know if you were answering yes or no, because the random number is secret. Oh, it does not work anymore. OK, so we'll reveal the answers at the end, but now we're going to ask you to respond again and to generate a new number, please. So is Gmail your main email provider? And I'll give everyone a second. OK. How many people say yes? So 6. And how many people say no? Eighteen, yeah. OK. And finally, I think you need to click to see the next one. Yeah, do you know how to main chunk? That's our third question. Please generate a random number again. And yeah, so how many of you answer yes to this question? 6. Oh. OK. And how many of you answer no? 18. Again, so the same as before.
Okay. Then we have the results.
So we have a negative number, which...
Yeah.
I have the feeling that some people weren't following the protocol to the letter, so might be that the first question didn't work so well.
Or maybe the population is zero.
So, well, this is our results. So here, well, this is the number of yes and no's that we counted. This is the proportion of yes and no, so the thing that we saw, but not the real result. The real result is here, and today our real result provides us basically an impossible probability here and zero here, which might mean that no one actually, or all the answers are no to this question. But we do have a margin of error, which in this case is, so this is the mean square error, and it's around 3%. So the actual results are quite precise. So they are in between a 3% error margin. I'm not sure what happened here with the negative. I'm sorry, people. But yeah. So this was, for example, one example that satisfies differential privacy, and but we are now going to see another example, and in this case we want to protect the average of a population. In this case, this is inspired by a study that we did, that we compilated the ages of people at our chair, and as you can see, there's a clear outlier in the distribution that you can try to guess who it was in our chair. But the idea is that we want to protect the average from this distribution, and we're going to do this in a differentially private way. So to compute the average, we basically need two things, the sum and the total number of participants. Then we're going to divide that. So let's start protecting the sum. And recall what differential privacy actually does. So it protects the absence or presence of any individual in the database. In this case, or here represented, the blue duck. And in this case, our result is simply the sum of all the numbers. And we want to that this sum of numbers corresponded to the first database, and this sum of numbers corresponded to the second database, so without the 27, is more or less indistinguishable for an attacker. And the way to do this is by adding noise. And there's a way to do this in it such that it satisfies differential privacy. And this is essentially the Laplace mechanism, which is a mechanism that adds Laplace noise to any query function. And this Laplace noise is centered around zero, so it has mean zero, and it's scaled with respect to the epsilon. In this case here, we can see how much noise we add with respect to the epsilon we want to achieve. The Laplace mechanism satisfies epsilon differential privacy. If we select an epsilon that's very large, we have a much weaker privacy, but we have a much better utility. Because the utility, or here the noise added, is very centered around zero, there's a chance that we are adding less noise, or a higher chance that we are adding less noise, and therefore we have less deviation or less perturbation. If instead we have a much smaller epsilon, we gain more privacy, but once again we have this trade-off with the utility, the noise becomes more sparse, and there's more probability that we introduce noise. And basically we also scale this noise with respect to the results that we had before. So in the previous example, we were summing ages, so we would like to scale our noise with respect to the ages. So here it would be, for example, convenient to add around 27 noise, so this to become indistinguishable. But the way to do it in differential privacy is slightly particular. So we scale it with what's called the sensitivity of the query function, which is basically the maximum difference possible between two neighboring databases. And we need to do the maximum difference between any neighboring databases because the definition of differential privacy imposes that this holds for any two pair of databases. So in this case, for our sum query for the ages, we cannot add simply 27 noise because this wouldn't hide a person that's maybe 120 years old from our database. This needs to be taken into account, and we need to scale the sensitivity as the maximum possible age difference, which we can impose to be 120 years or 125 years, taking into consideration the longevity records. And basically, and now that we have the... So remember that we are trying to compute the average, and now we computed the sum, and we have, and we know that the average is the sum divided by the number of values, and here we added noise to the sum, making the sum protected by DP. The thing is that the number of values is still unprotected, and the number of values do reveal the number of people participating. And in this case, if we see the total number participating, we know whether the blue duck participated or not. And therefore, this number here, the number of values must also be protected. The way that we do this is basically by also adding Laplace noise. So we are protecting both queries. The thing is, what's actually the privacy guarantees of applying the Laplace mechanism two times? Well, differential privacy has a very interesting result that allows us to give an answer to this. So we start, for example, with two differential private mechanisms, the one to protect the sum and the total, and we know that the composition of both results is going to be epsilon 1 plus epsilon 2 dp. So the epsilon is going to sum. In this case, protecting both numbers is increasing the epsilon. Here the epsilon increases linearly, which shows us the effect of composing multiple mechanisms. And composition is a very strong result, because it allows us to essentially compose any two differential private mechanisms, or any three or any four mechanisms. And it's always the sum of the epsilons. But now that we have both the sum and the total, we need to obtain the average. And here we have the other good property of differential privacy, which is post-processing, which essentially tells us that we can do manipulations on already protected data. So the sum and the total are protected, and therefore we can do operations with them. And when we do operations with them, this satisfies differential privacy with the same privacy guarantees. So it does not degrade privacy in any way. And this post-processing is always allowed as long as you do not access the original database. And that's good because it tells us that an attacker can basically not undo anonymization, differential private process. So you have a database that's been protected by differential privacy, an attacker won't be able to go behind or revert it through any function or any operation because it's protected by post-processing. And this is why differential privacy is the king of the privacy notions. It's the best way to protect information. So it's the Porsche of the privacy notions. And but as the Porsche has defined, it's perfect and it works effortlessly over very simple queries and, for example, our randomized response. But when we go to much complaint terrains like complex scenarios where we are trying to protect very complex data that are not simple queries, or we are trying to anonymize every value that's in a database, DP does not work. And this, together with the fact that differential privacy only provides good privacy protection for really low epsilons, but not really for high epsilons, and the fact that differential privacy does not work when the data is correlated, that means that there's some type of relations or connections between the underlying data, make differential privacy more limited in scope. So as here, differential privacy would work perfectly. Here, we are starting to get problems. And for example, we can see this for a published result on a published differentially private mechanism that protected basically images or faces of people in an image. And in this case, the neighborhood relation was defined as basically changing one pixel. So you would be protecting this image here, and the same image, or sorry, you would be making indistinguishable this image here and the same image with one pixel changed, which essentially is not a good protection mechanism. And furthermore, what we see here is the effect of correlation. So we know that every pixel is going to be more or less correlated with the pixels that are around it, because they're going to be the same tone. And through basic interpolation, we can actually undo the protection mechanism. And this is because even though differential privacy is assumed to protect independent and correlated data, but not correlated data. So this process can be undone. And this is the big problem of differential privacy. Differential privacy works so well for the things it's defined to do, that when you try to, that basically any mechanism that you have automatically becomes better if they have a DP label attached to it. But the thing is that this mechanism is still not good. And finally, there's also a big problem in the literature is that differential privacy is sometimes incorrectly applied. That means that people claim that their mechanism is differential private, but they provide no proof, so they provide an incorrect proof that makes it not differentially private. And the state of the art is actually quite worrying in this regard. So we did do a survey on differentially private mechanisms for trajectory data, so protected where you've been and at what time. And our results show that more than half of the mechanisms that we reviewed, or the mechanisms that existed at that time, claimed to be DP, but did not satisfy DP, which is a very big problem in the literature. And basically, this brings me to my summary. So differential privacy is the porch of the anonymization notions. It has a very, very strong mathematical formulation, which gives it a robust sense of privacy. It can also protect against very strong attackers, so it's an attacker that knows everything about the database, except if Alice participates or not, and it can still protect whether Alice participated or not. It can also is robust to post-processing, which basically protects it against any further attack, any potential attack that does not use the database, and also has composition as its property, which is very well, very necessary and very easy because it allows to simplify any mechanism into smaller mechanisms. It allows to compute how the epsilon or how the privacy budget degrades at every iteration. So composition is a very desired property that's not present for other privacy notions. But it also has a bad side. So first of all, very high epsilons are very dangerous. If you have a mechanism that if you have a mechanism that satisfies epsilon with epsilon equal 10,
that's not going to be a good protection or a good privacy guarantee. And what you would do in this case, it could be still acceptable, but you would need to provide some type of privacy evaluation, maybe some empirical privacy evaluation. So first of all, if you have a very high epsilon, you need to look if there's some other type of privacy guarantee analysis or evaluation. The other problem is that differential privacy can have limited utility for complex applications. So, for example, the anonymization of the images or of the pixels of the images, here we see a very limited utility and or a very weak privacy. Also, be aware that differential privacy does not protect correlations. So if your data is very correlated, DP is going to struggle, and it might not even be private. And also be suspicious of DP mechanisms that are not proven, because the literature are indeed full of some of these mechanisms that claim to satisfy DP and are incorrect. And with this, I give it back to Simon.
All right, thank you. So now we have seen there's great options to find provable guarantees for privacy mechanisms. But however, there's some cases where even that is not enough, and where being private and being indistinguishable from a group is not enough. So what we often see is that when we go see what companies are doing, they do privacy claims. So they claim, okay, our product is more private than another one, or we have privacy. And often they're missing one of the three, so they have to be, these claims have to be precise. So what is being protected? You have to be able to verify them. So if a VPN provider tells you, we delete the logs, you have to trust them, and you can't verify. It's just not a good claim. And they have to align with the threat model. So privacy mechanisms can protect very different things. So for example, in the case of DP, it's usually the identity or the indistinguishability. But there are also mechanisms to protect, for example, certain attributes or some anonymization, for example, for faces, saying, okay, we still keep certain attributes intact. And depending how big the group is, this then might not be enough. And yeah, so this means that privacy-enhancing technologies only protect certain aspects, and you have to be aware which they protect and which they don't. And there's also now the trend that companies use privacy as a label to say, okay, so they have developed something like the Torment Nexus and say, okay, we need to distract the people that it's actually a harmful system and say, okay, we apply, for example, differential privacy to it, even if that is the proof is correct, the epsilon is low, all is good. Having privacy for such a system that's harmful in its own is not helping. So if the system itself is harmful, privacy is not going to change anything about that. Privacy only helps when you have a system which has a good intention and has some privacy problems. So you collect too much data about people, and this could be then harmful. But if the system itself is harmful, this is not going to help. And this practice is called privacy washing. And essentially, it's using privacy claims to distract from the harm that your system does. Then here's some examples. For example, Ashley Madison was, a website where you could people to cheat on your partner. And they claimed to delete all the user data, even had like a feature where you had to pay for that. But in the end, just didn't. So here again is a privacy claim that was not verifiable and then also not true. And even with differential privacy, then now this label is often applied. And then, for example, Google has a framework for federated learning. And there they have an epsilon which is in the hundreds. So essentially, they have an upper limit, but it's so high that it's useless in practice. It's a little bit like saying, okay, there is a speed limit on the German Autobahn. It's the speed of light. See, there's a limit. It's useless in practice, so we can just ignore it. So as a conclusion, differential privacy is a great tool to get privacy guarantees which are provable, but usually you always need empirical tests to also then verify that this is also working in practice. And if the system itself is harmful, privacy is not gonna save you. So please beware of privacy washing that some companies do. That's all from us. Here are our contact details. And should you be interested in doing a PhD in privacy, our chair always has open positions. So visit our website, and we're now open to some questions.
Yes, thank you, Simon and Alex. So for the questions, you may ask them in German, and they will be translated by us, more or less, if you have any other questions. So, there's one.
Oops. Yes, thank you. You mentioned briefly in the first part of your talk about anonymizing trajectory data, location data, and how that is usually not done properly in differential privacy. Can you envision any way where that can be done in a proper way? Can it be done at all?
So the trajectory data is very complex. So there's mechanisms that do satisfy differential privacy, some with limited utilities. Also, at the end of the day, it's for also very limited queries or very limited scenarios. So there's a few mechanisms, but the data starts to become so complicated that in some cases, very hard to guarantee good utility results. That's the truth.
Thank you.
More questions? I would have a slightly, not to the core question, but what are other privacy methods beside of this that companies claim to use?
You know?
Beside of differential privacy. So somehow verifiable ways, methods, beside of this one, because you said it's a Porsche, but what are the others?
So there's other. So one of the most popular, I think I would call it the queen. Let's say if the differential privacy is the king, let's call this one the queen. I'm going to go to a database that I think is in the first. I do not know my slides here. So let's part with this example that here's the database. There's one privacy notion that's called k-anonymity. And the k-anonymity is much easier to understand than differential privacy. So the thing is that differential privacy is a property of the mechanism. K-anonymity is going to be a property of the output database, but I'm going to use this database as an example. And the idea is that in a database, there's different type of information. So this thing here would be identifiers. You would remove this. It is directly, so this is just like the image, let's say. So this directly identifies the ducks. This is what we call quasi-identifiers. If I tell you, well, my victim is a green duck. Good luck finding it in the database. But if I tell you, my victim is a green duck that's 0.8 kilos and 8 centimeters tall, then you might be able to identify this person in the database. And the idea of key anonymity is that these quasi-identifiers, and let's say this is the sensitive attribute that the attacker wants to know. So the idea of key anonymity is that we ensure that for every person, there's at least k people that correspond to that person. So let's say that we perturb these three values here such that it's the same. In this case, we will need a lot of noise, but you would select basically the things that are the closest. So if we do this, then an attacker that knows that Alice belongs to this group here won't be able to identify or know if she has bladder cancer or heart disease. So you could select K to be larger and you would protect more people, but that's another type of privacy notion, and I would say it's very simple, it has a lot of problems, but it's another type of privacy notion.
Okay, thank you. Some other questions? Well, then it's probably quite clear to everybody, so thank you. Yeah, thank you again for Simon and Alex.